Just for the uninitiated, we are in the quite near the beginning of a series of sermons entitled A Walk Through the Old Testament. We're going to continue it with breaks. Every now and then we'll take a break and take another series, but we're going to keep this going until we've gone right through the Old Testament, which will be sometime next year. Look out for that document I talked about, and you listening to the recording of this message, there's a document called A Walk Through the Old Testament. We've got stage one only available so far. We're going to let it go at 70p, that'll cover the cost, and I thoroughly recommend it. Now we're looking at Genesis 28. Genesis 28, we move on from Abraham, and we're looking now, tonight, at what we call a glimpse of heaven's gate as we come to the patriarch, Jacob. Genesis 28, looking really at verses 10 to 17, where we had our scripture reading earlier. That's page 24 if you're lost, but I don't think you will be lost, as it's Genesis. And then Jacob's words, right there in the middle. Then Jacob awoke from his vision of the staircase to heaven and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I didn't know it." Beersheba, that's where he'd come from, mentioned in verse 10. Beersheba hadn't perhaps been all that much of a place, but at least it had some of the marks of civilization, not least a deep well that Jacob's grandpa, Abraham, had dug himself, so we're told in Genesis 21, verse 30. You can visit the ruins of Beersheba today, as I have done. You can see the storehouses there and the residences. You can see the main street and the well, now about 3,500 years old. It's still there, and it's still got water in it. No, Beersheba wasn't too bad. But now, 70 miles or so to the north, Jacob, the reluctant hero of our story, is at, or he's rather near, a little nothing of a city called Luz, L-U-Z. It's a crisis moment for Jacob because he's on the run from his twin brother Esau. The sun is setting over the Mediterranean there in the west, and the citizens of Luz are about to close the city gates for the night, but Jacob, the fugitive, decides not to stay the night in Luz. Maybe it's too risky. Maybe he'd be betrayed to his brother Esau. So it's going to be his first night out ever in the open air, and he probably hadn't even got a tent. Or if he had got a tent, it's unlikely he'd have known how to put it up, because Jacob was that kind of person. Jacob was a man for the home life. He was a sort of pipe and slippers character, really, a bit of a mother's boy. And certainly his mum Rebecca doted on him, much more than on Esau. It's a bit sticky, this family, you see. Every time Esau came into the house, he left a trail about a mile wide. Arrows left all over the hall, carcasses from his latest shooting trips from the banisters or soaking quietly in the bath. It was a pain having Esau around as far as Rebecca was concerned. But Esau, well, he was awful. He would fill the house with his loud, hairy presence. But Jacob was, in Mrs. Isaac's opinion, a superlative example of successful male domestication. The Isaacs were a strange family. It does sometimes happen that greatness skips a generation. This was the case now. Everybody's heard of Abraham, of course, the giant patriarch of the Bible for faith. Only last week we were hearing of his obedient willingness to sacrifice his son Isaac, upon whom rested all the hopes for God's covenant purposes for the human race. So Isaac must be counted as one of the patriarchs, and yet he doesn't come over quite convincingly as a patriarch. The prominence seems to have leapfrogged over Isaac and landed instead on his own son, Jacob. Then as we look at Jacob, keeping clear of Luz itself that night for fear of betrayal, we can't for the life of us see where the greatness in Jacob lay. Here's the man who's going to be head of the 12 tribes of Israel. He's going to be famous. How was it that God ever shortlisted him for the post? Jonathan Dimbleby would have made short work of him on television. A mother's boy, a stay-at-home, a sly little cheat, egged on by Rebecca, his mother, He'd first of all persuaded Esau, the older twin, in one mad, hungry moment to trade in his rightful family birthright, doubling his share of the estate, for a casserole. That's what had happened. And later, when the time came for Isaac to bestow his dying blessing on Esau, at least he thought he was dying. He actually lasted for another 40 years. But at that moment, Rebekah overheard the plans for the blessing and dressed Jacob up as Esau. I expect you know the story. Then had a little rehearsal with him until he could impersonate Esau's voice as well as Rory Bremner, or maybe Mike Yarwood used to do, and ushered Jacob into Isaac's presence, holding an appropriate casserole in his hands. And in a 10-minute coup, Esau's birthright has gone down the plug hole. You can read all about it in Genesis 27. It was out of this kitchen intrigue that the God of all the universe, your God and mine, was to further his covenant agreement and bless the human race, establish the family of faith that has as its result the Christian worldwide family today. No wonder Jacob is cautious that night near Luz. He's running for his life. He is afraid. On an earlier night, while escaping, he'd been under cover. Verse 5 of Genesis 28 tells us that, at his uncle Laban's house. But now he's out under the stars, there in the wilderness, with a stone for his pillow. Now Esau could have done that, all right, without batting an eyelid, because he was a very earthy character who would think nothing of mixing in a brace of pheasants with his breakfast cereal. Not so Jacob. It's remarkable that Jacob was even able to sleep that night, but sleep he did, because we learn here in Genesis 28, verse 12, that God communicated with Jacob, seemingly for the first time in his life, through the dream and the vision of the ladder, or more accurately, perhaps, of the staircase leading from earth to heaven, with the angelic messengers spanning its entire length. The remarkable thing is that there's no stern lecture here from God, no recrimination, no get back to your father or anything like that. Jacob isn't even returning as a chastened and reformed prodigal. It's while he's out in the wilderness, alone with family and friends far, far away, that he realizes that God is very near. God is not left far behind. God is right there with him in the wilderness. Not only so, but that God is blessing him. It's there in verse 13. And it's a remarkable reaffirmation of the great covenant blessing pronounced on Abraham much earlier. It's a blessing of universal application, as verse 14 shows us. And your descendants, it says, shall be like the dust of the earth, and you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south, and by you and your descendants shall all the families of the earth bless themselves. That's God speaking to Jacob, the cheat. And we in the Christian family here, in the sophistication of London's West End, are a part of that worldwide blessing and covenant today, 3,500 years later. If there was a conversion point in Jacob's life, it was then at this place, Luz, which came, verse 19, to be called instead Bethel, which means the house of God. Because when Jacob woke up, verse 16, that was the overwhelming impression he had. God was in this place, and he didn't know it. It was a place of awe, more awesome than any church or cathedral. And when he woke up, he said, "This is the gate of heaven. I've met God here." He said to himself, I'm sure, let me build a monument. Let me build a cathedral. Let me put up, at the very least, a church. Well, I can't build a church. Let me put up a gospel hall. I can't put up a gospel hall. I'll put up my pillow. He found his pillow, which is a funny, hard little pillow, of course. It was a stone. But out of the pillow came a pillar, verse 18. And he set that up and said, "That is my monument, the gate of heaven. This is where I met God. This is my landmark. This is the landmark of my life." And later on people said, "Oh yes, there's Jacob's stone there, the gate of heaven. We call it Bethel now, the house of God. God's house is there." Luz became Bethel. And Jacob then, verse 20, makes what I think may be the first actual vow ever recorded in the Bible. to the effect that if God is indeed with him, then, end of verse 21, the Lord shall be my God. So Jacob, who had never mentioned God before, hardly at all, or if he did talk about God, he would talk about him as the Lord your God, he'd say to Isaac, his father. Jacob, whose very name means he clutches, or he struggles, starts on the road of knowing God, as it leads on to the point of chapter 32, when he finds himself one night struggling with a divine wrestler in his determination not to be away from God's hand of blessing. In Genesis 32, 28, God tells him that from now on he will no longer be called Jacob. He clutches, he struggles, but rather Israel, which means he struggles with God. And Jacob's life was never without struggle, never. Of course, he learned things during those struggles. Was he astonished to learn the lesson from the vision of the staircase reaching to heaven? To hear the words of universal blessing that would run right through him to the entire world? That's what God said would happen. In effect, God was saying to him, you didn't need to cheat Esau. Don't you realize? The birthright was yours anyway. You had it. It says so, actually, as far back as the birth of the twins. Genesis 25, 23. The one shall be stronger than the other. The elder shall serve the younger. Well, that was at the time of their birth. The birthright was always his. He didn't have to be a struggler. One lesson that you and I can take to heart is this. Just because life may be difficult for us at a certain moment doesn't mean that God isn't involved in our life. No, you may not see the angels ascending and descending upon the staircase in the way that Jacob did. Even so, heaven is only a hair's breadth away from the earth, and even more so now that we live in the era of Christ and the New Testament. Because you recall how in our second lesson, Jesus is recorded as saying to Nathanael, John 1, 51, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man. So the vision of Genesis 28 finds its completion in the incarnation, in the message of Advent and of Christmas that tells us that God has come close to us in our sorrows and our trials. He's come to us in Jesus Christ, who is the ultimate, the perfect stairway to God's love, forgiveness, acceptance. Read on in the story of Jacob, because we leave him at this point in our walk through the Old Testament, but read on, and you'll see that he has his share of pain, but God is there with him in his trials. And what of Esau? Esau had no pain at all. Esau seemed to lead a trouble-free existence. But Esau missed out on the blessing that was Jacob's. Esau was a less complicated character than Jacob. I wouldn't likely take Jacob as my next church warden, let alone be the next Bishop of London. But that's the story of God's workings. I want you for a patriarch, head of the family of faith, head of the 12 tribes of Israel, you, Jacob, the cheat, the clutching one, the grasper. That's the story of God's workings. He'll take the misfit. He'll take the ugly one. He'll take the one with a bit of a bad record. He'll take that awkward, angular character. He'll take the individual whom nobody is particularly keen to see elected. And he'll say, I'll elect you. I've chosen you, just as I chose Jacob. The gate of heaven. It's always a wonder, you know, to us ministers, well, to us Christians, when we meet with somebody who has just come to faith in Jesus Christ. Every so often we meet them. There were some this morning, started with Jesus Christ for the first time in their lives. And when I meet them, I want to cry. I think to myself, here's another example of what happened to me years ago. God taking somebody and saying, I love you, I'm tapping you on the shoulder for my kingdom, the gate of heaven. It's a wonderful thing to see. It's a great privilege. May we sense that privilege this evening here in church as we come to the communion service. And God says, I've chosen you to be an inheritor of my kingdom, a member of my family. But it was never easy for Jacob. Why, the next chapter brings him to a reintroduction with his uncle Laban, who is the complete shark, cheating Jacob out of his wages, cheating him out of his marriage, as Genesis 31 verse 7 says, cheating him and changing his wages 10 times. Jacob is terribly shocked to be cheated like this. After all, I mean, he's been converted now. Appalling behavior from Uncle Laban. Well, he shouldn't do a thing like that to me. Remember, he's seen the angelic staircase. Well, of course, it's only what he'd done to Esau earlier on. Yes, there's Esau. Esau also has to be reckoned with one day. And the thought sends Jacob's pulse rate up a lot. Sends him paranoid. He needn't have worried, as the story finally tells us. But it was never easy for Jacob. All the time it seems as though God is saying to him, relax a little. Stop the striving. Do it my way. I'm going to bless you anyway. And even when it's difficult, Jacob knows in the end that he's been blessed. He struggles with that stranger in Genesis 32. Why, it's God he's struggling with during that night of that encounter. And you see Jacob at the end of the encounter. Why, his thigh is out of joint, he's limping, his shirt is torn, he's terribly disheveled. And yet God has blessed him. People look at him and say, there's Jacob, he's just been blessed by God. Jacob, now Israel. And he knows it. And just because it's a difficult moment in life, it doesn't mean that God is not involved. 5 minutes before the breakthrough comes that we're looking for, that unanswered prayer, or that end to the difficulty that we may be facing in our lives, 5 minutes before the breakthrough, God is just as alive, just as active, as he is 5 minutes after the breakthrough has taken place. Israel, he struggles with God. The very name was a commentary upon this patriarchal figure from whom was to emerge 12 tribes. As I read through the story of Jacob, I'm amazed at the amount of pain he did face and difficulty. But God was with him in that time. God helped him to be patient in the end. God helped him, enabled him. So if there are sometimes those among us who find ourselves caught in that period of affliction or difficulty, misunderstanding, the thing is not getting right, come back to the thought, I don't want to be like Esau, who had no problems. Much better to be Jacob. I take as a tiny illustration of that, thinking of the exit of our Prime Minister. When she was made Prime Minister, 11 and a half years ago, whenever it was, I remember there was a friend of ours who took her little boys to see Mrs. Thatcher going to Buckingham Palace to be asked to form a government. She said to the two boys, come along, this is rather historic, woman being made Prime Minister. And then we'll have tea after that. So they stood outside Buckingham Palace. And sure enough, eventually the limo pulled up and out stepped the VIP, went into the palace. A few minutes later, figure came out again, everybody clapped and got into the car, drove away. Then she said to the boys, well, let's be going now. Come on, off we go, tea time. Just then she heard a voice, don't go, don't go. So she looked around to see who had spoken, but she couldn't see who it was. She thought she must have been imagining it. So she said again, all right, off we go then. Then she heard it again, don't go. So in mystification, she looked more carefully, and then she saw who the words were coming from. It was a policeman, standing looking straight ahead, saying out of the corner of his mouth, don't go. Well, she said, why shouldn't we go? Is there something else? Can't tell you, but don't go. Everybody else had gone. Everybody else. Hundreds of people swarming off, except our friend, Barbara, and the two little boys, waiting
patiently
outside the palace. They only had to wait 5 minutes, and then out came the queen in person. And they got a good deal that day, just for waiting, as the man had told them to. So sometimes when we are caught in the thick of an intrigue, there may be somebody in a business trouble at the moment, I don't know who you might be, believe that God is right with you there and saying, hold on, don't throw in the towel. Do you want to see the great coming back of Jesus Christ in incandescent glory at the end of the world? Then don't go. Hold on. Somebody a bit fed up with life in the church, oh, our fellowship group is awful, I'm having a terrible time in our group. Don't go. Hold on. Just as Mary did at the tomb that day when she was hovering around, thought, well, there's nothing to wait for, but I'm not going anyway. God blessed her, met her in Jesus. There's always more to learn if we're ready to learn. If the eyes of our spirit are open to see the nearness of heaven to us and to receive the grace of God. To Esau, life was a very simple affair. You lived, you slept, you woke up, you breakfasted, you hunted, you ate, you retired, you died. Had Esau but known it, by the time he'd shot and eaten his first rabbit, he'd already reached his ceiling. He was to go no further. The vision of the staircase from earth to heaven helps us all to place the ceiling that much, very much higher. And next week, it's Joseph. Let's have a prayer. Oh Lord, we find it difficult to understand why you loved Jacob and actually chose him to be your instrument for the world's good. We would never have chosen him. Your ways are past our understanding, but we thank you for this account of his life and of his strugglings, and that he struggled with you and became known as such. Go on, Lord, blessing us through him and his example and the covenant which was re-established through him that wonderful night in Bethel, the house of God. For your name's sake. Amen.